session is on Emily Dickinson, and it's the fifth of five. We started off talking about her poems on nature, and spent 2 days talking about her nature poems. Then we talked about her poems related to God. And then yesterday we talked about some of her love poems. And today we're talking about her poems related to immortality. Can you get it, Doris? Good.
It's okay if I close this door?
Yeah, please do. Thank you. Let me give you a copy of...
Thank you. Bertie just got back from his fishing trip, so he's in the shower.
Okay. We'll give him an excused absence.
Okay.
Or tardiness.
Yeah.
Either way.
Well, I doubt that it'll get here.
There's only one thing I'm interested in this one, and that is, did he get any?
Yeah, did he ever. Got lots of fish, and he wasn't expecting to, because the last time he was out, it wasn't good.
Well, I'm glad he did.
Yeah.
I'm glad he did.
Of course, they eat them up there at the
Heart Lake.
Yeah,
go
ahead over here.
Where did he go?
Heart Lake.
Heart Lake.
No, Dante.
Want to kick the door shut for a while?
Oh, here. Are you coming?
Is this poetry?
Yeah, this is poetry.
That's it.
That's it. That's all of that. Thank you.
A response.
I'm glad that Verlon is here because he asked a question yesterday to which I gave the erroneous response. I gave her age wrong, and it didn't sound right as I said it, and yet she was born in 1830 and died in 1886, so she was 56 when she died. I have been doing some work on Justice Olive Wendell Holmes of the Supreme Court. Not at all connected with Emily Dickinson, except he was born in 1840. And that's why I got the 1840 date in my head. And when I said it, it didn't sound right. She was older than 44. She was 56 when she died. Still a relatively young woman. And I also looked up, the cause of her death has been ascribed to, it still is somewhat in doubt, but Bright's disease is attributed to be the major cause for her health problems at the very end.
That's a kidney ailment, isn't it?
Yes, I believe it is, Doris, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But she had been a relatively healthy person, so her becoming a recluse was not really a health problem, as it was with many women of the 19th century, particularly spinsters, but not exclusively spinsters, who retreated from life. Many of them, among the causes for their retreat, would have been health problems. Not really in her case. When we talk about immortality in Emily Dickinson, we have to consider a pretty broad definition of immortality. For example, one of the poems that I like that I think relates to immortality is one that I think I said to some of you on a previous session respecting her use of words. She has a lovely poem about words, which runs as follows. A word is dead when it is said. Some say. I say, it just begins to live that day. Which I would interpret to mean that words have their own vitality, have their own integrity, have their own life, indeed have their own immortality. And I think that if she were defining immortality for us, she would somehow include the word. As something that can be immortal. There are, in the handout, a series of poems that I think are good ones to look at respecting to immortality, and they run... They start on page 8, at the top there.
We may ask you to read aloud if you have one.
I probably will. I probably will. But I won't call on anybody and insist that they be thrown out of the class if they don't read. What I do is much more gentle. I ask for volunteers. And there may be a certain shoulder dislocating persuasiveness to my request, but it isn't intended, right? Would somebody like to read Bustle in the House for us?
I'll read it.
Please.
The bustle in a house the morning after death is sullenest of industries enacted upon earth. The sweeping up the heart and putting love away we shall not want to use again until eternity.
I think I mentioned to some of you that I lost a sister last year. I was in Europe at the time, but I came back. And with my other sisters, the sister who died was not married, my two sisters and I broke down her condominium and settled all of her affairs. And it was a bustling time. And all the time that I was going through this, I thought of this poem. It's so appropriate in my experience there, because we were sweeping up the hearth and we were putting love away. But I don't think any of the three of us thought that it was forever. I think we realized that this metaphor is, we talked about it, is apropos that you put that love away, which was a very active thing in my life. It becomes, in the nature of life, more passive as time goes on. And I don't think about her as much as I did when I first lost her. She and I were very, very close. But it is there, the love is there. The heart retains the affection, but it is over there, packed away and in a place where it will be recuperable for eternity. It's a very accessible poem. It's one that one can read to a child. The child picks it up immediately and understands it. The next one, does anybody have any comments on it though? I've said before, and I want to reiterate that I hope that everybody will feel free to come on in and make comments, ask questions. And while I think of it, Verlon, you did one other thing, useful thing the other day. You asked me if I had a picture of it, and I didn't have this book with me. This is the only extant picture of Emily Dickinson. There are others which may be she, but I'm not prepared to accept that they are.
How old was she at the time that was?
This was 1847 or 1848, so she was 17 or 18. This would have been about the time, a little after the time, she attended Mount Holyoke, what is now Mount Holyoke College, which she did for three terms. She did not go back for her, what would have been her second full year, partially because, as we discussed briefly when we were talking about her attitude toward God, because she was not able to be among those who were saved. She was not willing to make the full commitment, and that was one reason why she became somewhat alienated, somewhat ostracized. Don't want to exaggerate it, but it certainly was one of the causes for her not going back. I should also show the book, The Final Harvest, which is available in the bookstore for your purchase if you wish. That's a plug. Ron.
These numbers that are on her combs, did she put them there? I mean, are they in order?
No.
How she
did? She did not put them there, Verlon. Another good question. No, those really are Thomas Johnson's poems, numbers. He numbered them chronologically as closely as he could come to doing that, which was a major undertaking. He had some help by previous publishers, starting with Thomas Higginson and Mabel Todd Bingham, who Mabel Loomis taught, and Thomas Higginson were those who first put her poems together, and they tried to do it chronologically. They were aided by the fact that her handwriting changed over the years, so that we can pretty well track when she wrote which poems, which helps a lot.
So we can look at these numbers and kind of gauge what, you know, about
age she was. Jan, plenty of places over here. Yeah, we can gauge about what the numbers are. In other words, poem 1775 would be, as far as we can figure, the last one that she wrote. And some of the earlier ones are ones that she wrote as a very young girl. Right. Right.
So her first published poem, I mean, the first one that you see in the book, she would have been 17 or 18,
yeah,
or younger.
Even younger. even younger. And in the complete book, which I also should have brought along, which I have, number 11 is the first one in our Final Harvest book, which is the same one as this, just an earlier edition, is number 11. Pardon me, and the first one is number 7, and there's number 11. In other words, the first six, Thomas Johnson did not think were ones that he wanted to put together into this selection of her poems. In the complete poems, they would obviously be as close to chronological as he could get. Right. Other questions or comments of a general nature? Please do feel free to come on in with them. Let's take a look at the next poem then, if we may, please. On page 8 in the handout. Would somebody like to try that one for me? By no means requires an expert reader. I simply want someone. Go ahead, please.
'Twas just this time last year I died. I know I heard the corn. When I was carried by the farms, it had the tassels on. I thought how yellow it would look when Richard went to mill, and then I wanted to get out, but something held my will. I thought just how red, apples wedged, the stubble's joints between, and the carts stooping round the fields to take the pumpkins in. I wondered which would miss me least, and then Thanksgiving came.
When
Thanksgiving came, if father'd multiply the plates to make an even sum, I would it blur the Christmas glee my stocking hang too high for any Santa Claus to reach the altitude of me. But this sort grieved myself. And so I thought the other way, how just this time, some perfect year, themselves would come to me.
Comments about this?
Obviously she was raised on a farm.
Quite right. It was a working farm. There where she lived, they had a field in which they had hay and they had animals. Right.
In the fall.
Yep. How about the reference to I heard the corn? Does that ring a bell for any of you biblical knowledgeable people?
When the ears of corn bent over and worshiped Joseph.
Mm-hmm. Right? That's what was certainly one reference. I looked it up. Hosea 2:22, the corn and the oil, there's one other thing also, were calling out to be taken in. That's the reference that she's making there. As I mentioned before, the Bible is central to her, so she would put a reference like that from the Bible in among all the homely kinds of things that you've picked up, the typical of a farm in autumn in a place like Amherst, Massachusetts. What's basically happening here? What is the situation?
She is weeping, is that right?
She's being carried by in her coffin, is that?
No.
Or she's leaving, or she has left.
Yes.
Left a year ago.
Last year?
Yeah.
A year ago. Right. So she is beyond.
Yeah.
Whatever beyond may be. She is in, the term she used to like to use was eternity. Eternity. She would never, I think, say about herself, in the sense that this is a kind of an imaginative evocation of herself in this situation, that she was in heaven. Or was in paradise, because she wasn't by any means that sure about her own worthiness, not being a believer. But she is beyond.
Well, that's what she means then. And then I wanted to get out.
Yeah.
She wanted to come back to her.
Yeah.
What that means?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think so. What, does this remind you of anything, of a play?
Our town.
That's what it always reminds me of. Every time I read this poem, it reminds me of Our Town. The Thornton Wilder play about the young lady who dies. And the final act of the play is she is in the graveyard and they come visit her. Her perspective is entirely different. I'm sure that Wilder knew this poem. I just have a sense that he must have done. So what we're dealing with here then is a person who has died, is in eternity. We might say in heaven, although she would not. Who then is imagining what it would be like. And that's what happens to the young girl in our time. Remember, she comes back. She actually comes back for one full day. Nobody can see her. And it's tragic for her. It's a tragic journey for her to come back. But she wants to do it. Because the fact that she's not there means that they can't appreciate her. Well, now here's a young girl wondering what the situation will be in very specific terms. What will it look like? What will it feel like? I wonder which would miss me least. That's a kind of a little girl's look, huh? I wonder if that brother of mine will even care. He probably wouldn't even care that I'm gone. He'd probably be just as glad. She doesn't really think that, but there's a little girl's inference there, I think. And when Thanksgiving came, your father multiplied the plates to make an even sum. The assumption being that it should be an even sum, or that it should be an odd sum, based on the number of people who are there. Do you set the place for the child who has died? Probably not. And would it blur the Christmas glee, my stocking hang too high, for any Santa Claus to reach the altitude of me? Will it change their feeling about Christmas that I'm not there, that I am too high? My stocking is all the way up, right? Wonderful homely references to get her sense of the absent person that she is vis-a-vis the real people who are there. And then the wonderful, she has such a kind of a positive spirit about her, a perspective of things, and then let's don't be morbid. Let's think of the time, the happy time, that perfect year, when they will all join me, when we will all come together. Very conventional kind of a Christian view of coming together after death. That lovely, touching poem. It's one of my favorites.
I feel she must have experienced the loss of the family member to have focused on how it's at holidays that it hits you.
Yes, and although at the time that this poem was written, she'd not yet lost her father and mother, who died early enough for it to affect, of course, the holiday time, but she had close cousins and aunts and uncles in the Amherst area, so that she was able to sense how that was there in their homes. Yeah, I think so. Any other comments on this?
Yeah, this could very well be the musings of, if not a recluse, the beginning of a recluse.
Yeah. It does have some of that introspection, doesn't it? And, yeah?
It's the year ago she died, if she was still in the vicinity, but not communicating.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a good point. Shall we look at the next one? It's up page 9. Somebody want to try this one for me? Please.
My light closed twice before it's closed. It yet remains to see if immorality unveil a third event to me, so huge, so hopeless to conceive as these that twice befell. Parting is all we know of heaven and all we need of hell.
Thank you. Those last two lines are probably the most famous of her lines. The lines that if one knows Emily Dickinson at all, one associates with her. Parting is all we know of heaven and all we need of hell. Here again, the perspective of the person still on earth vis-a-vis people who have died. She had lost two very close friends at this time. This poem was not written when she would typically have lost a a family member, but it comes more responsive to the time when she lost two very close friends, and the crushing burden of that grief is, I think, beautifully expressed in a tight, concise poem. And then the question, can this possibly happen again? Inevitably it must. Mm-hmm. Can I possibly bear it, is what she seems to be saying. So huge, the grief is so huge, so hopeless to conceive. Can't even imagine it, even when it has happened to you. As these that twice befell. And then the linking of the heaven and the hell in the feelings about parting.
This could also be, as you have commented, her two loves and the third to come.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
And nothing to do with the death of family members.
Right. These were loves.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any other comments on it or questions about it? Shall we look at the second poem on page 9? Anybody want to read this?
I heard a fly buzz when I died. The stillness in the room was like the stillness in the air between the heaves of storm. The eyes around had grown dry, and breaths were gathering firm for that last voice when they keenly witnessed me. I willed my keepsakes, signed away what portion of me be assignable. Then it was there interposed a fly. With blue, uncertain, stumbling buzz, between the light and me, and then the windows fail, and then I cannot see to see.
Thank you. What is the setting here? What are we dealing with?
The deathbed.
We're dealing with the deathbed, aren't we? What is the particular circumstance of this death?
Sounds like a death when you've got all the family around and you're sort of dealing with the last pieces of business.
The last pieces of business. What's the main piece of business, though, for those family members? And they might include not just family members, but friends, and the minister might be there, and others might be there as well. What is their principal business for being there?
The will, disposing of her possession.
Probably not. That probably would take place subsequent to the death itself. What is the event? This is a 19th century event.
All right, saying goodbye or the mourning.
Saying goodbye, but even more specific than that. Why would these people have been there on this occasion?
Last rites?
The death watch, the last rites.
Reading of the will?
No, I really think the reading of the will would come subsequent to this, of course. It was simply to be present at this cataclysmic event. Death was a much more tangible kind of event in the 19th century. It wasn't something removed, as it is for most of us. I mean, we have an undertaking to take care of these things, and we wouldn't necessarily all go over to my sister's house when she was going to die. Those closest to us might do so, but it wouldn't be a kind of almost a theatrical event, which it was. To see what happened. Here is this momentous occasion when this individual, when death comes into the room. You see, death personified was very, very real at that time. And in the particular religious orientation of the New England sects. To be present in that room when death comes in, death in some form, and there was much speculation about what was it like? There was much discussion of it. Well, what could you see? Was there a breeze? Did the lights go off? Was there a sense of the change in the air? What was it like when you were at Emily's death? Would be a subject for conversation. And to be there would be to be present when something really important happened in the town. So people would go. And it wasn't morbid, and it wasn't ghoulish. at least they didn't perceive it as being so. It was more the way Mexicans view death. If those of you who've been in Mexico know that death for Mexicans is a much more natural kind of life, part of life, and they treat the dead as very much part of the family, and they go to the cemetery to have a party, and bring a cup and a plate for the deceased, and have a party right there at the grave. When we first experienced that, us U.S. types were put off. But I've done it enough, so I'm not put off. I admire it. But in this case, too, it was different because it was just this one occasion present in that room. Well, we may say it's not ghoulish. We may say that it's an okay kind of event. But Emily Dickinson didn't think so. And this poem really is her expression, I think, of her disrespect for the ceremony or for the treating it as a theatrical event. Because the enormously significant, powerful manifestation of death in this poem is what?
A
fly. A bumbling, ugly, hateful blowfly. The anathema of the housewife in the 19th century, particularly because they didn't have all the ways of keeping these clean and keeping insects under control. A fly in the house was something just to bred filth. So instead of some great beatific presence coming into the room and sweeping up the deceased and taking him or her with the power, instead we have this insignificant, awful, silly, blue bottle fly. With blue, uncertain, stumbling buzz. Just a fly. So it's a wonderful takedown of all these people. So you can picture them then, having been at this death. What happened? Well, not really anything. I mean, nothing happened at all. Well, there was a fly. Fly? Yeah, that's really all there was a fly. And this is Emily Dickinson's zinger. She doesn't hesitate to make a comment on this whole ceremony, and it's a wonderfully satirical, ironical event. And she will do it personally. She's talking about her death. I heard a fly buzz when I died. And then she builds the scene. And then instead of the great presence, we have the fly coming in. And then the wonderful use of words in that last line. And two last lines, and then the windows failed, the windows standing for her eyes, and then I could not see to see. She has wonderful ways with her last lines. I love her last lines. She has one that we didn't get to read, but I wanted to at one point, where she talks about a person who's in a hopeless situation. And the person is so far beyond, the situation is so bad that the person is beyond despair. In other words, not just at despair, but at the point beyond despair.
Is it one of Emily Dickinson's? It's not in this, of that one where death comes by in the chariot?
I'm glad you happened to mention that. Why don't we take a look at that? That's a good one.
On this one before we
get please.
For the last onset, and these are the people gathering, mm-hmm. for the last onset, when the king be witnessed in the room, I can see the people coming to see whether this is going to be an appearance of God or an appearance of the devil.
Sure, absolutely. What do you think? Do you think Emily's going to go to heaven based on what you saw in that room? Oh gosh, no, she was just terrified. And she looked terrible. On the other hand, if she died with a beatific smile on her face, as though she were seeing the light, then maybe she was going to go to heaven. Yeah, those kinds of things were looked for. The king would enter into the room. The king would be one king or the other, Beelzebub or the good guy.
So even on the deathbed, you had to put up front.
Absolutely. Hear what he said? So even on the deathbed, you had to put up a front. For her turning away from her neighbors and coming here recluse, I think it was that. That the hypocrisy here, this is hypocrisy, she would say. Hypocrisy of having to die showing that you're going to go to heaven. Maybe you're not going to go to heaven, no, but boy, I'm going to really work. When I'm about to go, would you see if you could put my mouth into an up position so it'll look beatific and look as if I'm really going to go to heaven? That's almost more important than really going to heaven. Just to look as though. She couldn't stand it. Turned her off completely.
I can see her trying to scratch her nose where the fly had landed.
Yeah. I want to read the one that you asked me about. That's right on this kind of approach. Yeah, it's about a chariot. I'll read this one. Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. We slowly drove, we knew no haste, and I had put away my labor and my leisure too, for his civility. We passed the school where children played at wrestling in a ring. We passed the fields of gazing grain. We passed the setting sun. We paused before a house that seemed a swelling in the ground. The roof was scarcely visible, the cornice but a mound. Since then, 'tis centuries, but each feels shorter than the day I first surmised the horses' heads were toward eternity. Shall I do it one more time? Would that be helpful? I think it might, because it's chock full. It's chock full. Again, we have the person, the individual, presumably it's Emily Dickinson, having something transpire to her in the past. It had transpired to her when she was alive. And going through the transition to her present state, which is in eternity. Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. We slowly drove, we knew no haste, and I had put away my labor and my leisure too, for his civility. We passed the school where children played at wrestling in a ring. We passed the fields of grazing grain. We passed the setting sun. We paused before a house that seemed a swelling in the ground. The roof was scarcely visible, the cornice but a mound. Since then, 'tis centuries, but each feels shorter than the day I first surmised the horses' heads were toward eternity. So, what is the personification of death here? What is death?
It's a daily happening.
Yeah, it's a daily happening, right? Because assumedly a trip like this happens to somebody every day.
Yeah.
It's just a ride, just a carriage ride.
Yeah, but death itself, Roland, what do you think? What if we've got a personification of death here, and I think maybe we do, what does death come as, not, yes?
Well, I got it as a friend who is taking you for a ride in a carriage, and it's very peaceful and pleasant.
Mm-hmm. 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 Right. Is it a man or a woman who comes?
It's a man.
Yeah. He kind of stopped for me.
Yeah.
He's the carriage driver. Mm-hmm. Yes.
He's the carriage driver.
He's. Any other characteristics about him that?
Seems very polite.
He's very polite. He's very civil. And I have put away my labor and my leisure too for his civility. Mm-hmm. If somebody comes to you and is extremely civil to you and says, I just appreciate so much you coming along with me. You wouldn't say, well, I really have a letter that I've got to finish. Could you put it off for a while? if I take off my hat and I put it under my arm and say, I really would appreciate so much if you'd come with me. You'd be much more apt to do it than if I said, hey, you. So it's the civility of the carriage driver that you have a sense that she doesn't quite understand what's happening to her. She is busy. She's got the letters to write, just as you were doing things when I came in. You were busy doing things, so I didn't want to interrupt you. But if I had come in, and I was, after all, the carriage driver, then I would have had to figure how to interrupt you. And courtesy, extreme courtesy, is one way that makes people pay attention and want to do what someone is asking be done. I sense that it's a particularly important thing if a person is particularly courteous. So she's got things to do, right? She couldn't stop for death. She couldn't stop for death. She's too busy, right? She's like you, right? Oh no, I've got to do this now. I've got to get this ready before the class, and then I've got to do this. And well, I'm that way too around here in the village. You know, there's so much to do, so many good things. Go to the fish team. Got to go and see my friend and line up things for the Vespers tonight. This is, by the way, a dry run for Vespers, right? Verlon has asked me to read some poems for Vespers. So the poems that play here, mm-hmm. I'm going to take on the road and take them to the big show, right? This is off Broadway. I've already read some of these to Annie. To my wife Annie, that was off Broadway. Now here, this is off Broadway, and now we're going to take it. If it goes, it's going to go on Broadway into the big tent, right? Okay, so we'll see. We'll see which ones. So I couldn't stop for death because I was just too busy. But then he came in and he was so gentlemanly and kind in his suggestion that I take a ride with him. That I said, well. All right, I guess I can put these things off. I've got these things I ought to do at the village, but I'll take off and I will go on a short ride with you down the road. And then I realized that I was the only other one in the carriage except for the carriage driver and immortality. And then we drive along at no haste. There's no hurry. Kind of interesting. He's not rushing. It's leisurely. You know, no haste. And I had, for his civility, put away the labor and my leisure too. The things that I had to do, I put those away. And then we get a series of images, and I wonder if anybody picks up something from these lines, because they're always redolent to me of another poem. Does this remind you, any of you, of another poem where she says, we pass the school where children play, that wrestling in a ring, we pass the fields of gazing grain, we pass the setting sun. Is there another poem that harkens to anybody's mind?
We pass the corn over here.
We pass the corn, good. Yeah, we pass the corn on the same kind of journey, didn't we?
Mm-hmm.
There's another poem about a very similar kind of journey, maybe the most famous poem in American literature.
Whitman, Fields of Grass.
You got it. Well, it's, yeah, when Lilacs Last and Doria Bloomed. Right. About Lincoln's death and taking Lincoln's train, remember, from Springfield, Illinois to D.C.? The other way, wasn't it? The other way, from Washington, D.C. to Springfield.
Yeah. Is that Captain, Old Captain?
No, that's another one related to the same subject. But this one is where the body of Abraham Lincoln is taken from D.C. to Springfield for burial. And I got that right, or is it the other way? But he was killed in D.C., so they had to be taken back. Yeah. And they took him on a tour around, and the poem, which is an achingly beautiful poem, says what the train passed. And it uses the gerund. passing this and passing that and passing the fields and passing the people and passing the towns. Wonderful poem. And it has the same feeling of the peace following death. So now we're very concrete at the start of that. By the way, we passed the school, the children played, there they are, at wrestling in the ring. We passed the fields of gazing grain. We passed the setting sun. So now we're kind of out of time. We're kind of out of time. We're not talking in terms of specific time. Now the pace picks up a little bit too there. I instinctively read that a little more quickly. We passed the school where children play at wrestling in the ring. It has a sing-song time, doesn't it? The rest of it is much more complex in its rhythm until we come to that particular couple of stanzas. We passed the school where children play at wrestling in a ring. We passed the fields of gazing grain. We passed the setting sun. We paused before a house that seemed a swelling in the ground. The roof was scarcely visible, the cornice but a mound. And now we go to a much more complex kind of rhythm. Since then, 'tis centuries, but each field shorter than the day I first surmised the horses' heads were toward eternity. But it has a pretty straightforward kind of rhythm. Sometimes her rhythms are abstruse. You have to really puzzle through to see what she's trying to do, but they always have a reason. And of course, when she comes to the house, then the motion stops. And then the squire is no longer there. He's a squire, really, this gentleman type who is escorting her. Her companion is no longer there. And the squire never deceives her. Squires, he doesn't say anything, but she gradually gets the idea of what's happening to her. Yeah, this is one of my favorites.
Is that part about the house? I didn't understand that. Is she above the house?
Let me read it again.
We paused before a house that seemed a swelling in the ground. Pardon me, a swelling of the ground. The roof was scarcely visible. The cornice, but a mound.
What's a cornice?
Cornice is the architectural construction of the side, the roof. So it's a great. She's groping for identifying what it is, and then she realizes this is it. And then we get this wonderful perspective. Since then, 'tis centuries, but each field shorter than the day I first surmised the horses' heads were toward eternity. Your use of the word eternity there. It's eternity rather than any suggestion of heaven or paradise. She doesn't talk in those terms. There's one other here that has a similar kind of flavor. This one I also want to see about how it would be tonight. This, but it seems to flow right out of this poem. This is also a very well-known poem. I died for beauty, but was scarce adjusted in the tomb. When one who died for truth was lain in an adjoining room, he questioned softly why I failed. For beauty, I replied, and I for truth, themselves are one. we brethren are, he said. And so, as kinsmen met a night, we talked between the rooms until the moss had reached our lips and covered up our names. That's strong. That's strong. Beauty is truth, truth, beauty. That is all you need on earth and all you need to know. Any thoughts on it? Here we have a further spelling out, Verlon, of the architecture of the tomb. We talked between the rooms until the moss had reached our lips and covered up our names. Pretty strong. One of the strongest words in this poem, one that haunts me, is I died for beauty, but was scarce adjusted in the tomb. Imagine. Because that's the corpse. Now she's dealing with the corpse. She's not afraid to deal with this thing. That suggests the corpse actually being adjusted in the tomb. You obviously can't do any of the arrangements yourself in that tomb. You've got to have somebody do it for you. And that's what the word adjusted.
I wonder why she wrote so many poems about death. Is there some reason?
Well, first I'd say I don't think it's disproportionate.
Oh,
We're dealing today with poems about death, but first 2 days there's so many about nature, which are mostly the opposite. Mm-hmm. The opposite. They are full of life and abundance and vitality and hope and love. So I wouldn't want to suggest that she was. She clearly was not a morbid person. That wasn't in it with her. She was not a morbid person. But she was fascinated by the big subjects. God, death and immortality, love, family relations, what she called circumference was that huge sphere of life and death that we can't understand. Circumference for her was everything out beyond where we know anything. She was fascinated by that. And one place where circumference can be explored, maybe her favorite word, circumference, by the way. Circumference. One way to explore circumference is to talk about death. What does death mean? Is this all there is? Is this all there is? The other day when we were talking about her relationship to God, I took us through a series of poems that go to her fey and sometimes acid humor about God's unwillingness to reveal himself to us, which would then, it would follow, mean that immortality was as it is in the Christian faith, namely, we will join together with God after death. So her treatment of immortality is basically Christian in orientation, because she was a person who was deeply immersed in Christianity, and the Bible was her main source. But she had this skepticism. She was a doubter. She was a doubter. She was not a person who would go forward. Her sister Lavinia went forward in a great revivalist meeting of 1850 in Western Massachusetts. She said, I am a believer. And Emily couldn't do so. But the whole question of what happens with death, what follows after death, is a flood tide subject that she constantly was intrigued with. But I just want to reiterate that I think if you read her death poems, you come away thinking this is not a person who is morbid at all, not absorbed with death in a way that was at all unhealthy or pathological or even extreme. It was simply that she was a... Philosophers think about death. What does death mean? What happens next? And she was a philosopher as well as a poet. I want to have us finish up, if I may, just by reading one that I don't want to have us get away without doing. And that is on page 7, bottom of page 7. You really have to do that. May I have a volunteer to read that one?
I'll read.
Okay, good.
I like to see it lap the miles and lick the valleys up and stop to feed itself at tanks and then, prodigious step, around a pile of mountains and supercilious pier in shanties by the sides of roads, and then a quarry pair to fit its ribs and crawl between, complaining all the while in horrid hooting stanza, then chase itself downhill and neigh like Boanerges, then punctual as a star, stop, docile and omnipotent at its own stable door.
What are we dealing with?
A train.
Well, Boanerges is a horse. You write on. She uses the metaphor of the horse for the train throughout. Boanerges was a horse, classical horse, and stable door, because you see the train replaced horses. But if you think about it as a train now, let me just go through it quickly, and then we'll stop thinking of it as a train. I like to see it lap the miles and lick the valleys up, and stop to feed itself at tanks, and then prodigious step around a pile of mountains and supercilious pier in shanties by the sides of roads, and then a quarry bear to fit its ribs and crawl between, complaining all the while in horrid hooting stanza, then chase itself downhill, and neigh like Boanerges, then punctual as a star, stop, docile and omnipotent at its own stable door. Isn't that a great train? What a train. Yeah, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.